UFO contact from planet Iaga. Introduction. This is a true story of a UFO contact from a planet called Iaga, by the alien astronauts visiting our Earth. They say that their sun is about 10 light years as we count time from us, and that they have been observing us for some time. This story was first published in Dutch by Ank Hermes of Deventer, Netherlands in 1969 and has gone through 11 editions and 40,000 hardbound copies in Dutch since then. It has been published as science fiction up to now because the publisher originally felt that this story would not sell as fact. Nevertheless, it is a true account of real events and we are publishing it as such, here, for the first time, together with the very extensive follow-on data as the contacts continued right up to the present time. We have investigated this case extensively over the past 4 years and conclude that the facts do in reality verify and support the story. The witness is a very well-educated and highly articulate master mechanical engineer and an architectural artist as well, a rare combination ideally suited for this contact if the alien visitors wanted their information to be understood and presented with any degree of accuracy. The witness is also a well-known multinational industrialist in Europe whose real name would be immediately recognized. He is the owner of several companies doing international business. To preserve his identity in order to protect his private life, we are using a pseudonym given him by the extraterrestrials themselves. They referred to him as Stef van den Eerd, Stef of the Earth, from which Stefan den Eerd was derived. When I first met this man, I was surprised by his size. He is a big man, about 6 feet 4 inches tall and weighing perhaps 220 to 230 pounds. He dresses conservatively in expensive business suits and is very courteous and polite. He is mild-mannered and introspective by nature, and speaks with almost perfect economy of words. He says what he means and means what he says. In discussions, he is not given to elaboration and volunteers little information by himself. He answers questions forthrightly, directly and honestly, and looks one right in the eye as he speaks. He is not known to tell fictitious stories, but is considered to be a model of truthfulness and integrity. He lives in an upper-class quiet neighborhood in a professional suburb of Den Haag. His home, on a beautiful tree-lined street, looks to have a $150,000 to $200,000 value, and is well maintained and beautifully landscaped. It faces a park reserve across the street from him. The neighborhood looks scrubbed clean. This man was not a UFO buff and has no collection of UFO books and journals. He does not lecture or talk on his experience publicly or privately. He does not write articles on it or give interviews. He did not believe in the phenomena and had gone to no pains to evaluate if before his own contact. He still does not believe in UFOs as such. His experience was real and was identified. In the long course of contact discussions, he learned a great deal about our real history, where we have been and where we are going, and how we fit into this great universe. He found that our written histories are not very accurate because of our constant revisions by different regimes. He was shown a future course of events in store for us if we do not change our ways, and was then shown how fixed we are in our course and the improbability that we will change in time. He is saddened and discouraged by our lack of real progress, and feels that revelation of this information is a needless and ineffective burden for a self-destructive humanity. He does not see us changing in time. The first book, Buitenaards Aardsbeschaving, printed in Dutch, is an account of the contact experience up to the departure of the spacecraft the following day. The contacts continued, however, and a vast amount of technical information was communicated to the witness over the next several months and even years. The Iagans compared their society and their philosophies to ours, and described advanced technologies, man's place in the greater universe, and what is in store for all of us in the future. These communications continued and ultimately developed into a sort of mechanical transmission from a technical device aboard the spacecraft to the mind of the witness, something like the way it was done during his visit aboard the spacecraft in the Oostscheld, except that now the pictures were transmitted to his mind instead of viewing them on a screen. unknown to the witness, however, and this will be news to him when he sees it in print for the first time. Communications experts working with NATO in defense systems had picked up a strange incoming RF, radio frequency, electronic signal in the vicinity of a high-security NATO defense installation in the Netherlands, and became very disturbed about the nature and purpose of this transmission. It was in an unusual bandwidth and had a strange character. It also was only detectable within a limited area in Den Haag, The Hague, near where the sensitive installation is located. NATO intelligence, believing this may be an attempt to interfere with the defense installation and its equipment, moved hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of highly sophisticated detection equipment into the area to try to find out what was happening. It seems that this strange signal would begin about 4 p.m. and continue for an hour or more several days each week. Now, before this information came to light, my interviews with the witness had shown that his contacts were coming in several days each week on a more or less regular basis. The witness's habit was to come home from his office about 3 p.m. daily, read his personal mail and relax in his living room for a while. Often, when he was contacted, the telepathic transmission would begin about 4 p.m., and would continue for an hour or more. This strange coincidence became of paramount importance when I learned that the search for the strongest signal was taking them only a few blocks from this man's home where he was receiving the contacts. I don't know whether they have identified the source of the transmissions yet or not, and I don't know yet if there was any other transmission that may have occupied this time period by pure coincidence. In either case, I am sure that I could not be advised because intelligence information usually goes only one direction. A point of particular interest in this case is the fact that this witness was told by the Eargan visitors themselves that their group had contacted four other Earth humans in a similar manner, and had imparted similar information to each of them, and that once one of them got into print and became known, the others would make an attempt to contact him. This will certainly be a curious validation if any one of these others do in fact turn up. These contacts are still continuing on a lesser schedule and an unbelievable amount of information has been imparted to this man. Foreword from the author, this book is the account of a meeting with the crew of a spacecraft from a distant solar system in our Milky Way. There are many who claim to have spoken with alien beings, often resulting in strange or garbled stories. So many in fact that their credibility has decreased to almost zero. After my own experience, I think that I understand the cause of the problem. The honesty of these people is beyond reproach, but their ability as observers may leave much to be desired. These experiences take place in the zones between our normal, material method of communication, and the immaterial method that we usually describe as thought transference or telepathy. With this, the conditioning of the observer determines the quality of the reception. For example, subjects which do not affect him personally will, within his abilities, be received with the greatest clarity, whereas anything that touches him emotionally will be strongly biased or not received at all. Due to this, even a sworn statement from a completely trustworthy observer is useless, because no guarantee can be given that he knows what really confronts him. I realize that it must seem strange for me to warn the reader of the risks involved with this type of observer when I fall into the same category, but this is because I do not want to be just believed, partly because I know why a certain group of people refuse to believe. When you have read this book, it will be clear what I mean by this. The only means of checking the credibility of the observer is logic. Due to her cosmic isolation, humanity is ignorant in certain fields. And someone who really has communicated with a super civilization that has evolved above the material state, the minimum demand for interstellar travel, and understood them, must have access to information that is new, logical, and that can be checked in order to be convincing. As I have said, I do not seek belief, I ask my readers to be critical, but to bear in mind that the subject is so complex that it would be unreasonable to expect my story to be faultless. The content of this book is divided into two parts. The first is a description of the planet Eargan and her inhabitants and, as such, meets the demand for an identification procedure which is a mandatory introduction to all exchanges between intelligent races. The identity of a race is determined by its planet and its history, and these must be explained. The aim of the first part is therefore purely the identification of this alien race and is not an attempt to create some kind of picture of earthly ideals, something that we should try to emulate. Iaga is different in every way. The planet and her inhabitants have a different mentality and character, and therefore a different cycle of evolution. One difference is that Iaga is almost completely covered with water. The available area of land is spread over numerous islands with a total surface area not much larger than Australia, and according to our standards, is much too small to feed and accommodate the billions of beings needed to reach the goal of their creation. The extreme efficiency of their planning and food production methods would be pointless on Earth, and their population density forces them to a kind of over-socialized community. Only beings that possess the ability to continually improve their mentality and eliminate all aggression have a chance of reaching perfection on such planets. We do not have this ability. The reincarnation selection of Iaga does not exist on Earth. Here, the weeds grow up with the corn until the harvest. Despite the vast differences, a remarkable likeness can be detected in some things, so much so that these beings can be regarded as humans that have physically adapted to life on an alien world. Their intellectual, emotional, and creative capabilities are the same as ours, and if we had been placed in the same situation, we would have become roughly the same. When the second part of this book has been read, this will no longer cause any surprise. It will have become clear that these beings are not only our cosmic brothers and sisters, but that there also exists our ego counterpart with which we will one day be united. With the introduction complete, the real work can begin. The reason for their visit is so strange that preliminary explanation is necessary. The human race lives in complete isolation from the other intelligent races for as long as the so-called transformation phase continues. The plan of creation demands that we, like all others, complete the transformation phase in ignorance of our origin and our purpose. Through this we create our individual identity and, at the same time, have the opportunity to develop our godlike talents by exploiting our creative powers and defining them, thereby earning our immortality. The number of talent fractions is not infinite, so the time must come that the numbers of man are fulfilled. When this happens, the transformation phase will be terminated by certain external encroachments that will subjugate the will and sovereignty of the human race. The plan of creation forbids interference in the development of an ignorant race, thus the necessity for the planting of knowledge here on Earth. This knowledge appears to be comprehensive. To begin, the complete scientifically verifiable story of the creation, from the creation of time, matter, and energy from nothing, to the goal of the creation of the universe, the cosmic integration of all the intelligent races in one all-encompassing consciousness that is beyond our understanding. In this we are given a glimpse of the wonderful future that awaits us. Beside this, a great deal of information regarding ourselves, our origin, our development, the present transformation process, the spiritual development after death, our creation mandate, and our future is given. The first point is the most important. Only when we understand the creation process, and in particular the development process of man, can we understand and accept the reason for the external interference that will take place in the near future. Without this knowledge, the interference would be useless and therefore undesirable. Lastly, their information includes a general description of other intelligent races and their different evolution cycles, which will enable us to approach a determination of our unique position in the midst of an incredible number of intelligent races. The fundamental reason for this book is the abolition of Earth's isolation and the announcement of the fulfilling of the numbers of man. Our first mandate was carried out in ignorance, the second will be carried out in full consciousness. The only question that remains is to what extent does this book reach its goal of removing the Earth's cosmic isolation? The question is all the more impelling when it is said that I had to give my word never to attempt to prove the existence of Iaga, because this would damage the individual freedom of mankind. I have fought with this problem for many years, until at last the problem solved itself. Even though I shall continue to avoid giving a direct answer to the question of the veracity of this story, the immensity of Earth alien knowledge contained in this book will serve to prove beyond a doubt that the planet Iaga is not fiction, but fact. Stefan Dennard and W. Stevens, Chapter 1 Confrontation, Iaga, I can talk about it now. The fascinating dusky green planet with its somber pink sky is no dream but just a moment. I must first sort out the mass of information gained during my astounding experiences and relate it logically and coherently. I need to do this for myself as well. Any explanation of my chaotic memories may help me to become my old self again. It is difficult for me to remember the man I used to be. How I felt that beautiful summer evening on board my yacht that drifted like a huge white swan on the windless waters of the Oosterschelde, an art of the sea in the southwestern delta of the Netherlands. Hey, Dad, do you know that the compass is broken? I took no notice. It was probably just one of my son's childish jokes. I sat stretched out in a deck chair, contentedly sipping my coffee and surveying the distant coast of Suwandewive Land, an island in the delta, where we planned to arrive before dark. On the small strip of land above the horizon, I could see the light that marked the harbor entrance at Bergslui. Honest, Dad, it's broken. Come and look, persisted my son. Still disbelieving, I forced myself to stand up and walked over to where my wife, son and small daughters were standing looking at the compass as though they had never seen it before in their lives. Something was definitely wrong. The map was hanging at a crazy angle, but worse still, the north indicator was pointing in the direction of the Zeeland Bridge, to the east. I looked accusingly at the discoverer of the trouble. It wasn't out of the question that my young son was playing a joke on his father with a magnet. I was disappointed to find that this was not the case, and so I started a serious investigation. In the meantime, Miriam did the dishes and put the children to bed. By the time I decided to return to Bergslui on the motor, it was getting quite dark, and the fact that I had been unable to find the cause of the trouble irritated me immensely. Miriam was right in saying that I should not let a compass spoil such a beautiful day, but I could not rest until I knew what was wrong. Ah well, I could do that in the harbor. I pushed the Jolk, an old-world, flat-bottomed sailing ship, at full power through the darkness of the Oosterschelde. There was a light buoy. I read the number automatically and turn sharply to port. In the distance lay the next buoy, marking the channel to Bergslui. About 6 miles and we would be home. But things didn't go quite the way I had planned. Something unbelievable happened. Suddenly, out of the darkness, a strong, blue-white searchlight shone in my eyes from a point directly in front of the bow. And at the same time I heard a high-pitched whining noise above the noise of my motor. My heart pounded. It came so unexpectedly, that it must have been several seconds before I acted. Reverse, full power. Damn, it was too late. With a frightening noise the Tjolk came to a standstill against something solid, but what? Who on earth would be in the middle of the channel without lights? With shaking hands I stopped the motor and in the sudden stillness saw the startled face of Miriam appear in the cabin doorway. Is anyone there? I yelled over the water. In answer the light went out, but no reply. Miriam came on deck and behind her stood the children, wide-eyed with fear. Look. That flat thing in the water. It looked like the hull of an overturned ship or pontoon. But we were at least 30 feet away and couldn't possibly have hit it, whatever it was. Is anyone there? I called a second time. The searchlight flashed on again, the strangely small beam of light swept over the water and cast a cold glare on the side of the Tjolk. I caught my breath. Floating on the incoming tide was a body, face down, apparently dead. The actions that followed were carried out at nerve-wracking speed. There was only one thought in my mind, to do something quickly, before the body drifted away into the darkness. How they stood on the ship floating when he first saw them, picture of Jim Nichols, pictures not from book. Instinctively, I carried out the motions that I had so often gone over in my mind in the event of one of the children falling overboard. Seconds later, I jumped overboard with a line from the lifeboat in my hand. But what now? I was standing in less than 3 feet of water, and my knees and ankles hurt from landing on something as hard as steel. In my confusion, I saw the line from the dinghy drifting away. I stood up and dived to catch the rope, and, swimming with the small boat behind me, managed to grab the body. It wouldn't move. How would I get such a weight into the boat? First, tie the rope around him, climb into the boat myself and pull his head above the water. Yes, that was it. Just then an alarm signal began to sound somewhere in the back of my mind. What kind of a man was this? He was wearing a kind of metallic suit and around his head was a rubbery ball which reflected the blue light so strongly that I was unable to see his face. I began to think about astronauts, but how on earth did he come to be in the Oosterschelde? I started the outboard motor and began slowly back toward the Djulk, but what now? What should I do with this strange burden beside me? Why had I gone to all this trouble? My indecision grew by the minute. The blue light made it plain that I must carry on. It was kept in my direction by someone who followed the rescue closely from beginning to end. But what did they want? In terrible confusion, I came at last alongside the Djulk, tied up the dinghy and stopped the outboard. In the silence, I heard the voices of Miriam and my eldest daughter. Thank goodness everything was all right there. Then my peace of mind received its death blow. There was suddenly a sea of light, a great diffused light under the surface of the water. A sound made me turn toward the strange object in the water and I saw a dark shape wading quickly toward me. It was a perfect copy of the being I had fished out of the water, with the same shiny metallic suit and a transparent ball around its head. Step by step, it came closer, and I instinctively grabbed the boat hook to defend myself. He held out an arm in a friendly gesture and turned his face toward me. I sprang back as though bitten by a snake, a wild fear cut off my breath. It was a nightmare. A terrible, indescribable feeling took hold of me. The being in front of me was not human. An animal-like face, with large square pupils in the eyes, eyes which were both hypnotic and self-assured. It struck me like a thunderbolt. Here I stood, facing an alien being from a race more intelligent than my own. But why was I still so afraid? I cannot explain. If it had been a gorilla, for example, then I would have quickly sprung on board my ship and put up a fight with the boat hook to prevent the animal from coming on board. There would have been no time for the fear that came from the feeling of helplessness in recognition of his superiority. The fear grew into panic, a panic which told me to get away from there as quickly as possible, before it was too late. I sprang overboard again and raced through the shallow water toward the ship as though the devil were at my heels. Panting, I pulled myself on board and started the motor. Reverse full power. I wanted to get away from there as quickly as possible. The ship didn't move an inch. Over the bow I saw the being pull the dinghy onto the dark platform, lift the body in his arms and walk away with robot-like steps. It suddenly went dark and they were gone. With a feeling of apprehension, I stopped the motor. The situation on board was surprisingly peaceful, for they had no idea of the real drama. There was a feeling of satisfaction over father's ability as a lifesaver. My eldest daughter had developed the theory that we had rammed a submarine, which was not so unlikely, considering we were dosed to a naval training area. Only Miriam realized that something was wrong. She looked at me as though I were a stranger and her uneasiness grew by the minute. She had never seen me like this before. She poured me a whiskey and sent the children to bed with the excuse that we had something to talk over. The alcohol did me good, but now it seemed that I had another problem. Miriam didn't believe me. This trip is too much for you, Steph. There are no men from Mars in the Oosterschelde. She kept talking, perhaps to try and talk some courage into both of us. I couldn't just stay inside, I had to see what was happening outside. With a flashlight in one hand and a boat hook in the other, I stood on deck and let the beam of light play over the platform. It lay just above the surface of the water, a sinister four-looking dark gray thing. Its diameter was about the same as the length of our ship, certainly 50 feet. It was resting on a ledge, which reflected the light so strongly that it looked like glass. In the middle was a pillar, slightly twisted, about 6 feet wide and 8 feet high. The total size of the thing surprised me. I knew what was under the water. I could walk at least the length of a swimming pool without falling off the edge. Could this be one of the much talked about flying saucers? Were they really so huge and could they also operate underwater? I turned the flashlight out and began systematically probing around the ship with the boat hook. In front, by the bow, about 2 feet, and aft, about 4 feet. It was strange that each time I had to use force to pull the boat hook off the bottom, as though someone were holding it. Suddenly I remembered the strange trouble with the compass magnetism. We had collided with a huge, magnetic monster. We were imprisoned, stuck fast on a huge magnet. In the grip of strange, unearthly beings. The only possibility of escape was the plastic dinghy. In case of emergency there was room for all of us. The dinghy still lay in the same place on the platform, and in the peaceful stillness of this complete isolation a daring plan was born in me. After all, the dinghy was only about 30 feet away from me. For the third time that evening I jumped into the water, waded as quickly as I could to the boat and pulled it free. Within half a minute I was back on board with a dinghy alongside. So, that was that. I began to regain some of my self-confidence. But my uncertainty came flooding back as I heard a scraping, hissing sound. I grabbed the searchlight and shone the beam on the platform. On the edge, a sort of lid hinged open slowly and steadily. Out of the hole crawled two figures, dressed in the now familiar space suits, who pulled out some objects after them which were joined together by cables or wires. Their movements reminded me of the old-time silent films, fast and jerky. What were they doing now? They stood on the platform and, with one hand against their ball-shaped helmets at about the height where their foreheads would be, made slow, respectful bowing movements in my direction. I understood. What a relief. It was a greeting, a friendly, respectful greeting. With quick, short paces they walked to the edge of the platform, where the bowing was repeated and emphasized, and then they stood like statues in the light of my flashlight. A strange and dramatic scene. On the Oyster Shelter man is confronted with an alien intelligence. But the man was poorly prepared for the meeting. He was nothing more than a sailor in difficulty who could feel his legs trembling in his wet clothes. The two figures in front of me were about 5 feet tall and from a distance looked deceptively human arms, head and legs, all in their proper places but their legs were shorter than ours so that their arms reached down to their knees. Their metallic costumes were smooth and seamless. Only by the shoulders and elbows were folds to be seen. The short, heavy legs ended in broad feet that also stuck out behind, and the front part of their footwear was split in the middle. The hands were covered by supple, ribbed gloves. These were different from ours to in that not only the thumb but also the second finger was enclosed. They were heavy, claw-like hands. A broad, gold-colored belt around each of their middles, sewn with motifs and tools, was particularly noticeable. One piece of which was dearly a hammer with a sharp striking edge. And on their right side was something that vaguely resembled a pistol. A kind of drum, wound with thin glistening thread, rested on the middle of their stomachs. The remainder of their equipment was unknown to me. I gained the impression of immense physical strength, not only from their long, heavy arms and enormous shoulders, but also from their quick movements. The round ornaments around their heads were less transparent than I had originally thought. When the beam from my flashlight fell on them, they changed into glistening Christmas tree balls, and only with more indirect light was it possible to vaguely make out their heads. The silent confrontation was suddenly broken by a bud voice. "Do you understand English?" I nearly jumped out of my skin. Owing to my surprise that they could speak English, I didn't realize that they had asked me a question. The voice was totally devoid of any questioning tone. It sounded more like a statement. "Do you understand English?" The same statement floated over the water. "Yes, I do. We want to thank you for the rescue of our crew member." Dot. "Of course. Who are you?" "We come from another solar system." "My God," I called back.